they essentially preach something of a gospel about technology being the leading mover of history. They believed in replacing the state with a board of engineers. They were anti-democratic. They wanted to replace money with energy vouchers. They were also very religious in their thinking. They thought, you know, you could create a Garden of Eden through technology.
Hello, I am Cody Ellingham, and this is The Transformation of Value, a place for asking questions about freedom, money, and creativity. Today, I'm joined by Anton Ceballo, a writer and historian. Anton is a student of modern history and has been published by Noema, The Guardian, The Brooklyn Rail, and Palladium. Anton, how did your writing career start?
Well, for me, writing was an outgrowth of my interest in history. So from there, I started writing on Substack, I think in like 2022 or so. And a few of my themes that I was, I'm very interested in like social history in particular, contemporary stuff, but also contextualizing contemporary themes, especially history of social history, history of tech, psychology applied to group dynamics and how politics operates. It's only the last 2 years or so I've really been taking it seriously, but I've always feel like I've been drawn to writing.
Yeah, and where did this interest in society and technology come from in particular?
Well, I've always been a bit of a tech skeptic in many ways, especially in the way the cognitive changes people have experienced. And as somebody who also wrestles with, like, as we all do, addiction online, it's very, technology nowadays can be a very, it's even if you feel you're conscious of its effects on you, you're still wrapped in it. You can't escape it in a way. And I am of the belief that technology is molding, it's probably the dominant force molding people today in the sense that there's a lot of unconscious factors at play, and it creates referential loops in people, so they think they're getting information that otherwise maybe they didn't come to themselves. And I think technology in general is like it's like accelerated in the last two decades, just in the last two decades, I think. You really see the social consequences of the inclusion of tech in all of our lives. So it's a natural. It's for me. It's very socially rooted. I see it everywhere. So it's impossible not to think about it.
I was looking through the bio of your Substack, and I think you write that my perspective starts from the view that we're living through something of an inflection point. One of its major catalysts is a deep and widespread feeling of uprootedness, largely caused by online life. And it seems maybe since COVID, there's been this malaise amongst people, this inability to disconnect. Certainly, I see it around me. People are always on their phones. And there's a kind of question about, well, what reality are they living in when they're always online, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me also, in the way I kind of structure my, like, since coming from like history writing, I do like applying frames to how I understand things. And one of the frame definitely is like this like acceleration. But the other frames, I think, are you also have like a lot of things compounding at once. So you have the tech component. You also have geopolitical rivalries, which are heating up. And then on top of that, you have changes in how like capitalism operates. Like a lot of production is immaterial. A lot of it is backed by financialization. And labor is becoming less and less relevant to the creation of value. So all of these three things, like the social component, the geopolitical component, and then the financial component, are all kind of converging, I think, in what I would call like these are basically the growing pains of what we don't know what's coming next. But I think when you frame this all together as one narrative, you start to see how things are converging on some kind of on a lot of unknowns, and that's why I characterize that as like an interregnum, like a transitional period.
Yeah, that's this idea of frames is quite interesting. I find sometimes people tend to want to speak to a single lens or a single way of exploring history or current affairs. But maybe you could tell me a little bit more about that. Leah, what does it mean to look at things from different angles and through different frames? And is this an established historical methodology?
Yeah, I would say. So thinking historically is not exactly intuitive. Like people think of history usually as like a collection of factoids or something, but really you have to assess certain trajectories. You have to assess like where things fall apart. What are the junction points? what are there ideological forces at play, social forces at play, how do they converge? You're looking at structural forces. Of course, individuals are operating in a structural environment. So you're really looking at a lot of different variables. And it's not really, for I view history like a science and an art at the same time. Like, is a there's a narrative to it that's obviously very artistic, but at the same time, there's also a hard empirical basis for it. And for me, history also is, this is like a debate within history. You know, you talk about teleology, like the trajectory of history, where things are headed. And I'm somebody who is definitely attracted to those kind of narratives, assessing history as a kind of a march towards something. And it necessarily doesn't have to be progress. It could mean just that the fact that assigning some kind of directionality to it is, I think what gives people in the past has given people a lot of meaning in the sense that we're working towards something, we're headed somewhere. And that's what motivated a lot of ideologies in the 20th century. And nowadays, I think the one of the few ideologies that actually proposes that is technocratic thinking, in the sense that technology will relentlessly keep improving. And that seems to be the one narrative that a lot of people, even if they disagree with it, they assume that technology is going to keep moving forward. And that's, I think, a logic that's like very ingrained in thinking nowadays.
Yeah, well, speaking of technocracy, this is what I reached out to you about, your recent article, Welcome to the Technocracy, The Dreams of a Forgotten Movement from the 1930s Live On. I'm keen to dive into that today. So can you tell me a little bit more about what is technocracy?
Yeah, so technocracy is, it actually has a rich history in the United States in particular. And you have to really put it in the context of when it emerged. So we're talking about the beginning of the 1900s, there's a big industrial revolution in the United States, and a lot of industrial problems popped up in urban centers, and a lot of social issues also emerged. There was a huge push for what would then be called progressivism. And a lot of these thinkers at the time in the early 1900s viewed industrial society as leading the march forward, and hence, wouldn't it be logical that the leaders of industrial society should lead society? Or rather, you know, that they would be the most knowledgeable about where things should go. And from there came this kernel, which would be technocratic thinking, which is that society should be run by a group of appointed experts. That's one of the kernels, I think, one of the founding principles of technocracy. And from there, you had other thinkers who emerged in the 1910s and 20s. One of them was Thorsten Veblen. He was initially more of a socialist, but then he started to become, he was like a pro-labor thinker, theorist in the U.S. And he was based in the New School. But eventually, by the 1910s and 20s, he started thinking more about industrial systems and engineering. And so in the New School in New York City, he formed the Technical Alliance, which was a small group of people from the 1919 was their like founding years. And that's also when the term technocracy was officially coined. And this group was mainly responsible for creating research papers on capitalism. And they were, one thing that's strange to us, like now when we think of technocracy, we think of, they're so associated with big tech. But the original technocracy movement was very anti-capitalist. They viewed capitalist waste as something that needs to be managed technologically, and that if only we had technical experts at the top, capitalism could be steered in a more efficient direction. And that was their worldview at the time. And from there, the movement kind of splintered, fell apart into irrelevancy because there was the big 1920s boom. And then the 1930s, the Great Depression was ongoing with the crash in 1929. And then technocracy really exploded in the American consciousness. You had characters like Howard Scott, who was a very charismatic engineer, bohemian type in Greenwich Village. He formed this group called Technocracy Incorporated. And they had hundreds of thousands of members in the United States. And they essentially preached something of a gospel about technology being the leading mover of history. They believed in replacing the state with a board of engineers. They were anti-democratic. They wanted to replace money with energy vouchers. They were also very religious in their thinking. They thought, you know, you could create a Garden of Eden through technology. They were believers in centralization. And they were also skeptical of all politics, all political parties, and they viewed themselves as the as essentially moving what they considered to be the only important the main catalyst for progress, what they viewed, which was technology. And the movement fizzled out. It was highly discussed and popular in the 1930s, but eventually a lot of its members were exposed as having not having scientific credentials. They were, a lot of them were kind of grifters and scammers. And Howard Scott himself had a disaster of a radio appearance in 1933, which was attended by a lot of the top bankers and artists and media personalities at the time. And he bombed it completely. He ended up getting criticized ruthlessly in the papers. And the movement kind of fizzled out. But I think a lot of it remained in the public consciousness, this idea of technology being the prime mover. And technocracy then, I don't think people called themselves technocrats necessarily after the 1930s, although there are some exceptions, like in the 50s and 60s, there were some writers who were operating under that. But I think nowadays when people say technocrat, they think of it's often used as a stand-in for not political. So we're going to appoint a technocrat that's supposed to be an expert, right? That's like the common colloquial way people talk about technocrats. And even recently, with the Gaza war ending, Trump appointed for the Gaza peace plan, and the peace plan is an appointed committee of technocratic experts, which is supposed to appeal to allegedly like all parties, because it's like an impartial type of board. And that's that language that is coached in that kind of, you know, technocratic language. But when you think about technocracy today and the old movement, I think a lot of their ideas have been revived. And in particular, we can go into this a little bit, but I view a lot of tech elites today, although they weren't reading the old technocrats, I do think a lot of their ideas have been unconsciously revived. And now they don't need to appeal to a popular sentiment like the original technocrats, because they own the lion's share of the world's capital and also can work in conjunction with the state and operate basically in silence.
Yeah, that's fascinating. This character of Howard Scott in particular was quite fascinating for me. You quote him in your article in that the case for technocracy was simple for Scott and his followers. Engineers and mechanics created this civilization, so they will eventually dominate it. And there's a sense of a intellectual elite, this kind of this role of the top elite committee, these technological experts overseeing every facet of life. This idea that we could through science and mathematics, we could define the ultimate form of society. I find this very interesting, this kind of algorithmic approach. Which I wonder whether, just going back briefly for a moment into maybe the history of this, it seems to connect quite deeply with the idea of the Enlightenment, of humanism, of the perfectibility of human institutions. There seems to be, talking about these kinds of trajectories of history, it seems to me that this idea that we could build a perfect system for humanity seems to stem from that maybe rational moment in the Enlightenment. And I wonder whether you would agree with that, or whether you'd see some nuance to maybe some of the end games of the technocracy movement being maybe developed earlier with this scientific revolution.
Yeah, I think rationalism plays a huge part in this, because, I mean, rationality is definitely an outgrowth of the Enlightenment. And there were early technocrats that preceded the 1900s who perhaps, although they weren't living in that kind of industrial society to imagine, you know, to properly enact a technocratic worldview, those conditions only came by the early 1900s. And even then, I mean, technological systems were nowhere as advanced as today. So I don't even think Technocracy Incorporated, the original movement, could have enacted any of their vision. It seemed completely far-fetched. But they were really enamored by the poetry of it. That's basically, and I think that also applies. There were people, I think, associated with the, when you think of like early rationalists, like the during the French Revolution, there was definitely a cadre of people in the revolutionary state who viewed, although France at the time was not very industrialized, they definitely viewed industrialization and the growth of reason and the management of the fruits of industrial labor as the ultimate goal of revolutionary change. There were people writing during the French Revolution about that topic. And then by the 1900s, people oscillated because, it's interesting because the working class, emerged as a new political actor on the scene. And there were people definitely writing from the perspective of the emerging capitalist class, the engineers. And they were considered to be, they can take the reins and they control, because they are the ones who would be most, allegedly most knowledgeable about industrial forces. And that's why Thorsten Veblen, who was one of the founders of Technocracy, he moved from being pro, essentially socialist or sided with the left, with the IWW and these kind of unions, like the radical left unions in America, and switched over to what was essentially more of a position that any future governing body has to be made up of largely of engineers. And so that's I think that speaks a lot to the thinking, how things changed in just that early 1900s, that period of transitional thinking. Yeah,
and I've got a quote here, which I think comes from Henry Saint-Simon, and which was expanded on by Frederick Engels. The government of persons is replaced by the administration of things and the direction of the processes of production.
Yeah, Saint-Simon is a given. So Daniel Bell, who was a thinker in the 50s and 60s, he was pretty much he called himself a technocrat. He viewed himself as, and this is Cold War post-1940s, when you had a big consensus in American power. And Daniel Bell was writing that ideological wars are over. All we have is technological progress. And in his mapping out of, mapping out technocracy and its origins, he places the origin with Saint-Simon and the French Revolution and human rationale. What's it called? I think he had a term for it in particular.
Yeah.
That making rationality as the end point of human progress. So,
it's interesting to me as well, Anton, that this period of the 1930s in particular, this movement sort of gaining steam around the time of the Great Depression, maybe a lot of change in the world, it also coincides with, I think, maybe you could say in the dark rise of things like eugenics and the eugenics movement, at the rise of fascism in Europe, and these ideas of in Europe and elsewhere, including in Japan where I live, this idea that we have maybe systems for understanding different kinds of people. The racial differences can be measured, and the classic image of the scalp calipers and these kinds of really quite disgusting images developing in this time. And so I wonder whether you see a connection there, alongside even things like A Brave New World, Aldous Huxley's well-known novel exploring these ideas of different kinds of humans, different kinds of people, and in particular around this question of intelligence. And do you sort of see how do you see that connection with Technocracy?
Yeah, I think Technocracy was definitely had a lot of it was indebted to a lot of those theories that were floating around eugenics. I mean, Technocracy inherently, even though it took a very populist flavor in the 30s, it was a deeply elitist philosophy. I mean, because I was looking through some of the magazine articles in Technocracy Digest, which was one of their magazines at the time, and they're pretty open about viewing that the leadership is just biologically superior. So there is language of eugenics baked into Technocracy. Mm-hmm. And on top of that, too, which is kind of strange to us today, I don't know how else to describe it other than it's fascist adjacent. I mean, it's fascist looking. Like, if you look at the Technocracy rallies, the way they're dressed, the way they were very interested in creating a social space around themselves. So they officiated marriages. They had special parades. They drove the same cars. They had these matching uniforms. They also did Roman salutes, which was then not associated exclusively with the Nazis, but it was generally seen as a militaristic posture, And they viewed themselves as revolutionaries, essentially at war with the state in many ways. I mean, they didn't take up, arms or anything, but they definitely viewed themselves as oppositional. And this led to them being banned in Canada in 1940. So you had elements in Technocracy that were definitely influenced by not just fascism, but eugenics And in general, I think a elitist philosophy that was perhaps was imported from Europe, but also had a lot of origins in the United States, belief that oligarchy was natural, belief that hierarchy is natural, belief that biological superiority is embedded in people, and you can, if only you could sniff out the superior people to lead, then they would, you know, you could create technological Garden of Eden type situation. So all these ideas are floating around at the time.
Yeah. For sure. Well, that's interesting. And you mentioned Canada as well. And I believe Elon Musk's grandfather, I don't know which side of his family, one of his grandfathers was involved with the technocracy movement in Canada, right?
Yeah, he was. He actually has a weird history. Yeah, his grandfather was definitely had more of Nazi sympathies than a lot of Technocracy Incorporated members. He wasn't talking to Technocracy Incorporated in the U.S. He was in Canada, so they had a different branch there. But he was on the far. I mean, I didn't look too much into him, but I'm pretty sure he was allied with the Afrikan, like, whites-only government in South Africa and things like that. So he moved around a lot. He was in Canada, then he went to South Africa.
So this is interesting. So we've got this history of a kind of a trajectory of history, let's say, of the idea that we can use technology to build systems to optimize this kind of rationality, which is quite a profound idea that maybe we've in a sense incorporated into our lives today. But it wasn't always the case. You know, there was, I think, if you go way back in time, you know, there was a different kind of time before technology in the enlightened sense, where, you know, maybe life was more cyclical. People maybe were closer to the land, maybe ways of living that are quite foreign to us today. But where we sit today, Anton, I do wonder whether you see a relationship between technocracy and neoliberalism as it sort of has emerged over the last 40 years.
Yeah, that's like a pretty rich question. I mean, I do think that neoliberals and technocrats, especially if you look at the Chicago School of Neoliberals and Hayek and these other writers before them, the Austrian School, they had a skepticism towards politics, very similar to technocrats. And so, but the technocrats themselves, I mean, this is why you have to differentiate between the old technocrats and today. The old technocrats were not they believed in command economies. They wanted the state to actually reorganize goods and distribution. So they definitely were not neoliberals in any sense of the word. But I do think that this like dislike of politics and the public, like not trusting political rationality, not trusting political organizations, and instead wanting to replace that with either the market or technocrats. And neoliberalism is like a term that I think gets thrown around a lot, and I wonder really if, because I haven't really looked at these in comparison necessarily, because neoliberalism is such like a catch-all term people apply, I think, to just situations where there's privatization or things like that, whereas technocracy is also just as big of a catch-all term. So you're kind of putting like two very broad definitions in comparison. It's kind of difficult to discuss them in tandem. But if you have any specific
I understand that, and I appreciate your comment that they are big encapsulating ideas. My thinking over the last a few months, to be honest, is I have been deep into the neoliberal rabbit hole and looking at particular at some of the, I guess, the ideas that come from it around the inevitability of certain things, around the things like market fundamentalism, which in a sense sees markets as perfectible systems to, you know, the logic of society can be kind of based on this system of markets that is built from first principles. Whereas I think, I mean, what we do see in reality is that there's always a political aspect, there's always a social aspect. But the idea, just like communism would say that, you know, there is a perfectible system, that there is a trajectory we can take towards the utopia. Maybe technocracy says through technology we can get towards the utopia. Free market fundamentalism says we can get to this beautiful, prosperous world through the institution of free markets. And I've been diving into the work of John Gray, who is quite a critic of neoliberalism, and he says that fundamentally, maybe what we can go back to is a more conservative worldview, which just accepts that we probably can't perfect human systems. We can try and negotiate and work together to improve them, but to kind of look for the silver bullet of history, to assume that we've solved the riddle of history, is folly. And I think this is an interesting idea, because we see this with neoliberalism historically, that free markets will fix all our problems. That we just need to calibrate the market properly and have it set up in the right way, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, I'm very partial to that view too. And also in neoliberalism, it's interesting how today's technocrats, I'm talking about Peter Thiel and his supporters in particular in Silicon Valley, they view themselves as essentially saving capitalism. So I'm not sure they would ascribe the neoliberal era post-80s as necessarily creating innovation. Peter Thiel oftentimes talks about we're living in stagnation, and he was talking about this in the 2010s. And so in a way, he views the purpose of technology is to get us out of this stagnation that the last 30 years produced. And that, I think, is very much in contrast to the neoliberal.
Yeah, well, it's also interesting that, and I guess the way I would connect this is that I think neoliberalism over the last 40 years has developed in tandem with this financialization of everything and the development of, you could say, the apparatchiks, the technicians of global finance. And I think this is illustrated with the banker kind of 2008 global financial crisis kind of class of kind of spreadsheet people who maybe don't have a connection to reality. They're moving these things around on computers. Arguably, 2008 was the moment when neoliberalism really revealed itself for all of its internal contradictions. But the idea that from a computer that these spreadsheets can move the physical world around, I think that was quite a profound idea, and that only the most qualified and well-paid people in the world can do that. And so we're seeing more and more people pulled into that, the quant kind of space, right? And in a sense, that world of finance, of Wall Street, you live in New York. What does that logic mean? Where a lot of the times, these derivative, products, these financial products, they really don't make any sense. You have to be coded in that jargon, in that technical language, to really even understand how they work. And I just wonder whether there's a connection there with maybe what the earlier technocrats were looking at as maybe more industrial systems, whereas now these are more kind of information systems that are having this technocratic financial class managing them.
Yeah, I think definitely the early technocrats were more industrial in their worldview. I mean, nowadays, I can't think of any in Silicon Valley, very few, maybe who work in like the military sector or something, who are eager to reindustrialize. I mean, I guess electric cars and like Tesla and stuff like that. But generally speaking, yeah, you're generally in the realm of the immaterial and numbers and bits. And additionally, too, when you think of today's technocrats, I don't think it's a general my criticism of financialization and the way the economy is going is that a lot of tech companies and a lot of these who have achieved a lot of political power through the financialization of the economy, and by this I mean rising stock market valuations and things like that, that's how they accrue political power. And you can't really assess like value for like Google per se or like Meta. It's like difficult. It's easier for an industrial society to assess value because it's very linked to production of goods. Whereas a lot of financialized instruments today are being traded on narratives, or they're traded on expectations of the future, symbolic, like a group, what your expectation is of how others will react to news. It's all very strange, and like it gets to a point where I'm not entirely sure that revenue. In fact, oftentimes today, revenue is bearish. Companies post their revenue sheets, and then the stocks tank because it's better to keep it open ended. And
There's a really interesting book from the 90s called The Sovereign Individual mastering the transition to the information age. And I do wonder if there's connections here between sort of like the industrial age and the information age. But the authors talk about how in the future, market forces, not political majorities, will compel societies to reconfigure themselves in ways that public opinion will neither comprehend nor welcome. As they do, the naive view that history is what people wish it to be will prove wildly misleading. And the authors also talk about this idea of mega political changes, including technology or the climate, the environment, going all the way back to the agricultural revolution, that there's things bigger than political forces that shape, I guess, the contours of history. And I mean, do you accept that idea that there is such a thing as mega political forces? Is that are we merely, you know, floating along on the ocean of these mega political changes, such as technology or the climate, or is there actually an opportunity for, you know, what we think of as politics to drive human institutions? Like, is there? I mean, what is the conflict between those two? Can they work together, or is one more dominant than the other?
Yeah. I think. So you kind of have to think in terms of, well, I'm also somebody interested in what's the boundaries of politics, the possibilities of politics. And I'm also definitely somebody of the opinion that there's not really anybody in the driver's seat. We are kind of taken along for the ride in some way. But I also reject in many ways this like long form historical analysis that tries to ascertain these like cycles of history that precede modernity. And I would characterize modernity as like the 1700s, like the break when capitalism really began in like England and then spread, also the development of capitalism in the Netherlands, then spread throughout the entire world. And from there you had actual interest-bearing capital, you had money being generated from money, you had the rise of industrial like the plants in England. And additionally, also, you had the expansion of commerce outside of like Bullionism. You had like actual mercantilism, like proper mercantilism, and then development of capitalism. And that naturally creates a lot of social dislocation from communities as they come to the urban centers. And really, the trajectory of when people try to apply, like that to me is like happened only by chance. It's like capitalism, in a way, it's like a, think of it like a social laboratory, and then something broke, and then it spread throughout the entire world. Because capitalism really is like a self-perpetuating system, right? And the question is like whether or not political forces can contain those economic forces. Can they? And there is like a lot of antagonism through it between the two. And I guess what to bring it back with what you're asking in particular, politics for me seems very ill-equipped to deal with these problems, especially since a lot of democratic states are suffering from deep inertia and institutional inertia. And also, politics is an arena that is very much an alienated space from public life nowadays. Like, I can't really say that, you know, how politics was 60 years ago is very integrated into your average life. And by that, I mean political parties. There was like a sense of a home in politics. And like nowadays, I don't think that exists. So increasingly, we're looking at like complex systems that are making people feel invisible. And that, I think, is actually motivating a lot of resentment nowadays. And a lot of politics nowadays is being motivated not necessarily by your self-interest, because, you know, perhaps politics isn't speaking to those, but it's actually motivated by a desire to be seen. There's oftentimes a lot of oppositional element to it. Incumbents can't stay in power for long. It's just like revolving door of like elections. So that, I think, is evidence of like a deep transitional period in the way politics is dealing with a lot of the structural complex changes that are happening that people can't really ascribe any narrative to. So they're very much, it's almost like the public is, like, because politics doesn't represent the public interest, the public is in a way lashing out with these populist parties and anti-establishment parties that I think is evidence of like a very, the growing pains of some transition that's like ongoing.
Well, I find it interesting though that, again, tying this back to neoliberalism and the, I guess the common sense that the state is incapable of doing anything efficiently, that there's always this kind of largesse, that there's always these problems with government projects, and that maybe that being a self-fulfilling prophecy. And so, of course, the private sector and free markets, and supposedly free markets, are the solution. And this kind of this weakening of state power, and also the weakening of civil society, so that we end up with this fundamentally red versus blue, as opposed to the plurality and kind of nuance of civil society and various kinds of community groups, in a society. And I wonder whether this story of neoliberalism can also be tied up with what the development and rise of techno-nationalist China, which obviously with Tiananmen Square and the changes in the 90s, very much took a step away from the idea of political franchisement. And so now we have this kind of existential threat to somewhere like the United States in the popular narrative of China as a techno-nationalist state, where they're building bridges and railways, and they're led by engineers. This idea of the technocracy, the Dan Wang's book, Breakneck, the law and the lawyers of the United States versus the engineers of China. And I wonder, that development of China was enabled fundamentally by the neoliberal project. And so prior to that, it was a backwards economy. It was this communist Soviet style economy. And it was neoliberalism that kind of gave it the capital, that gave it this market access to grow. And at that key turning point, where there could have been democratic reforms, there were not. And so we're seeing maybe that as a model of authoritarianism, of a state, a capital state without politics, in a sense. And so I wonder if that perhaps is the kind of image that the technocrats were looking at in the old days.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of truth to that. Also, I apologize if the conversation's all over the place, because these are kind of big themes.
Sorry, yeah.
Oh, good. I like that. But when you think of technocracy today, I think China is definitely the leading example of it. Another example would probably be the European Union, although they're more bureaucratic than technocratic. Although there have been elected officials in the EU that have been bona fide technocrats, like Italy is famous for having a committee of technocrats in the state. During COVID, they had a lot of that in the government. But China, I think, is definitely the standout example. And what preceded China was obviously another technocracy, which was the Soviet Union, which failed in solving this problem of distribution, and also was bogged down in a lot of foreign commitments that it ideologically it really couldn't commit to anymore, financially also. But China, I think, is, I wouldn't say that, it's funny because a lot of technocrats in the U.S., and I'm thinking specifically of Palantir, they frame their merging with the state as necessary to defend Western civilization. So they frame their technocratic aspirations as essentially as Americanism. They view it as necessary for the fight against China. And I was reading actually an op-ed, I think it was a month or so ago, by the it's not Alex Karp, it's another, I think he's not a CFO, I forget exactly his position, but he wrote an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, a very aggressive posture towards China, actually. Alex Karp has also spoken publicly about this, because I think there is this, the U.S. military is very slow to innovate in a way, and they've outsourced a lot of innovation to the private sector, Silicon Valley. And so Palantir stepped into that void to fill in light of this contest with China. And so American technocrats are using China as a way to justify their expansion and integration with the American state. Whereas on the Chinese side, I wouldn't say they have gotten rid of politics per se, but they definitely are very afraid of cultural politics. And by that I mean breaks in the narrative, stories the public tells themselves. They don't want any schisms in those stories. That's why they're very interested in social engineering. They're interested in cultural politics. They're interested in assigning values to their society. So they have whole committees in the state that are dedicated to establishing state-approved values that the Chinese people have to, follow to be good citizens. And then obviously you have social credit system and things like that. And the Chinese learned this from the failures of the Soviet Union. So the Soviet Union were the original technocrats, and they, even though they were ideologically on the surface, preached this kind of revolutionary communism, the public wasn't, if you actually look at by the 1980s, there was no belief in that system per se. Like, people were essentially, it was all dress up. And if you listen to President Xi's, I think it was a statement in 2013 to the whole Politburo, there was like a speech he gave. And he specifically talks about historical nihilism as the reason the Soviet Union fell. And that means people stopped believing in the story of their society. They stopped believing in their own history. And so that's why it collapsed. So for China, they have this technocratic side, but they also have this cultural side, which is obsessed with making sure there's a coherent narrative and value system so that things don't implode, because they're constantly in the shadow of what happened with the USSR. And I think the West and China are in a way converging on technocratic thinking. There is definitely, I think, shared aspirational expert, the appointment of technicians and the merging of the state with these like tech companies, which in China is like very natural, especially conglomerates and things like that. So there's a converging on those things, but they view themselves opposed on the cultural questions. And that's how Palantir and them justify their technocratic aspirations.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned Palantir CEO Alex Karp, and I believe he's got a book called The Technological Republic. Yeah, it came out recently, and it's, I think, speaking to these themes, as you say, the idea of these large tech companies merging with the state to stay competitive in this new world. Anton, I want to dive into this question of money and the way the financial system works. We alluded to neoliberalism, the financialization of everything, this massive growth and this kind of data-driven, computer-driven class of global finance of somewhere like Wall Street, where they can really affect change anywhere in the world with their spreadsheets. And this idea of money in particular is really interesting to me because we see today the maybe the idea of central banking fundamentally as perhaps a technocratic institution. Generally speaking, central banks are unelected. They're driven by these economists, these quantitative people. And in a sense, that really is part of the key engine of power of the state today is through the central banking system. And so I know there was some early technocratic critiques of that. There was ideas like energy money, energy coupons talked about in the early technocrats' manifestos. And so I wondered, maybe just opening that topic of how sort of the technocratic approach to money sees value, how central banking fits into all of this, and maybe we can go from there.
Yeah, that's like a very rich theme because it's a little bit Marxist in origin, like this labor theory of value. But for the technocrats in particular, they viewed the energy costs of a system to be very much like what the currency should be based on. So, and this also comes from not just, you know, technocrats. This allied them with a lot of left-wing groups also who were experimenting with voucher systems based on labor. But in this case, the technocrats had since they were skeptical of capitalism, they viewed it as creating a lot of waste. And so to remedy this, they believe that if you restructured the workday and you created a system of energy accounting, which essentially would, and this is where it gets very, in a way, I would view this as like slightly totalitarian, not slightly, but it is totalitarian, I would say, like the complete state control of social life where everything is counted, like all your consumption habits are counted, all your expenditures are counted. And this would be essentially documented in a ledger. And from there, the state could create a rationing program based on energy that's expended in the system. And these would all be centralized among a few key industries. And that was how they imagined what they called the technate would operate. And when you think of that today, it sounds a little like they didn't possess the means to even be close to implementing that, because that's like way too complex for a state in the 1930s to even attempt. But I think this concept of like energy and this like currency that's like really currency the way it exists today is like a relatively recent like phenomenon, like the free floating exchange rates and the lack of any standard for currency. So that's like a pretty recent like development in like the global economy. And so they were responding to what was at the time a crisis of the gold standard. Right. So there was actually a lot of debates on what currency should be based on in the 1910s and 20s. This was not like a given. And there was crises and, you know, strong political movements in the U.S. who were arguing that it should be based on silver, gold, or maybe some other form of currency. So when we think about currency today and how we take it for granted because it's backed by military power and this like Pax Americana, I mean, in the 1910s and 20s, this was not a given. I mean, you know, the British Empire was in decline after World War I. The gold standard was temporarily suspended to fund the war. And so a lot of things were, notions of value were out of whack. So the technocrats emerged at a moment when these were open questions. And even though they couldn't have implemented it, I do think it speaks to the how a lot of these concepts about currency are very, actually, they're not as stable as people assume. They're very, they're prone to disruptions all the time.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that there's this history of currency, right? And obviously, at this inflection point just after World War One, you know, the question, you know, that I think the UK tried to reinstate gold, and there was this massive differential between what the value had been and what it had become, and there were issues, and I think the kind of acceleration of the world as well throughout the 20th century meant that maybe older ideas of hard money, of specie, of gold, didn't quite keep up with the developments of the telegraph, of radio, where stock markets were able to move, you know, across the Atlantic much faster than the hard money settlement could happen. I think there's a lot of things that feed into that. But then I think what's interesting, though, is if coming back to the central banking piece, again, though, that you know, some of the most powerful institutions in the world are these unelected technocratic institutions developed. A lot of this emerged from the 1970s onwards, when we had the separation of central banks and governments. But certainly the development of the Fed in 1913 was I think, the beginning of this, in a sense, the key, you know, the crown jewels, quite literally, of the state, its ability to print money, its seigniorage capabilities came from this unelected technical institution, you know, which again is founded in the case of the United States by the industry leaders of the banking world. And so I wonder how that sort of feeds into it. You know, are we living in a kind of a play democracy, a pretend democracy, where, you know, we can vote for the government, but certainly we can't vote for the central bank and its mandates? And so is there maybe a connection there, do you think, towards perhaps an elite project around the way money works in our modern economy?
Yeah, I think it's, when you look at the history of the Fed, I mean, it emerged out of, which I think was a genuine social need, which was, there was a lot of bank runs that happened in the 1880s and 1890s. And then you had J.P. Morgan Chase step into, when he was essentially the wealthiest man in the country, if not, I mean, maybe not on paper, but he had enough collateral to essentially bail out a lot of the major banks. And I think he was, the federal government requested he step in because there was no lender of last resort other than him. And so under this history, the Fed was created. And it's funny because I ascribe a lot of meaning to political forces and economic forces. And I do think that while the Fed is like a lever in this, I'm not entirely sure that when it comes to economists and the technical abilities of economists, I'm always very skeptical because they don't actually, I think I was reading something like, when you look at the actual predictive power of economics, it's like abysmal. Like, it's, you might as well like roll dice, because it's, for all the theories, it usually doesn't produce a lot of predictive capabilities. But when it comes to the Fed itself, I'm somebody who is, I think, a bit of like a financial nihilist nowadays, in the sense that I view the way the value is being created, the way it's going, I'm not very convinced that it's rooted in anything real. And from that perspective, I think it's funny because I remember speaking to people who were like post-Keynesians and these people who don't necessarily view anything wrong with money printing, in the sense that it's just as long as you are the most dominant issuer, you can basically, you know, print until it doesn't matter anymore. And that's like an attractive like idea if you want to create like a, you know, complex social program or something. But I do think that it, when you put in context of like declining American power and all these other components, I do think there's like a hubris that the American financial system has created for American politicians, and that they're living in a kind of delusion about their own limitations. Like, they're not aware of the limits of the American financial system. And that for me is very evidenced by the fact that the recent Iran war was really a huge blow to the petrodollar. Like, the Gulf states are actively engaged in propping up the dollar because the oil is traded in dollars. And so for Trump to pursue this policy is for me evidence that a lot of American elites view the American financial system as almost like preordained to always exist, when that's not necessarily the case at all. And this is like a classic story of how imperial powers suffering from their own hubris end up like destroying themselves. And
yeah, well, I guess what I'm trying to get at, Anton, and I appreciate, or I hope you understand, you know, there's a big topics and a lot of moving pieces, but you know, my interest is in, I do feel we are at an inflection point as well. I agree with that. I think something's changing in the world around us. And part of this show's interest is the idea of money. And in particular, I've been quite interested for a few years in Bitcoin as both a new way of looking at money, but also an old way of looking at money. Bitcoin kind of pulls on some of these ideas of energy, of hard money, of something like the gold standard, but it also brings it down into a place where it's also accessible by you know me or you can use it. And so there's a kind of decentralizing force there. There's a kind of quite a democratic force involved. And so in one sense, I'm able to look at Bitcoin as an extension of neoliberalism. It's a way of getting your money out of beyond the reach of the state. It's a very powerful force that's aligned in some ways with these, you know, big tech forces. But at the same time, it's also contrary to that. And I think that kind of dynamism is quite interesting. I think people sometimes maybe take sides, and they see it as maybe a negative, that it's crony when, you know, Trump is pumping it with his speeches and that sort of thing. On the other hand, though, I think there's something really powerful about it, because it is fundamentally, through this cryptography, kind of beyond the reach of the state. And it's kind of got this more existential kind of mathematical power to it, which is quite a big idea to grapple with. And I just wonder whether you've encountered Bitcoin, or how you sort of see that fitting into this whole landscape that we've looked at today.
Yeah, I'm very familiar with like the history of Bitcoin, and myself also having spoken to people. And I would say I think it's very useful as a hedge when you're dealing in places of instability and high inflation, like Lebanon or Venezuela or Turkey. As for whether I think, like, it is interesting you put two different perspectives on it. One is that it's either, I do think when it comes to just crypto in general, there is a lot of irrational hatred of it, because I do think it is a very something about not having intermediaries and, you know, this like zero knowledge proofs, cryptography, this kind of stuff is very, I think, attractive to me in particular, because like intermediaries are usually the politicized nepotism of systems, right? So that's like a very attractive prospect. And if I was to, let's say, speak about like how a state should be reorganized in the future, it would definitely be less intermediaries, not more. So in that sense, like, yeah, I'm very interested in like cryptography and those kind of systems. As for Bitcoin itself, this is where I think it gets like super complicated, because I do think the narrative around Bitcoin has changed, because initially it was supposed to be digital cash, and now it's like a store of value. And I can't say Bitcoin itself is really, it'll never, it's not really expendable in the same way cash is. And another, I think, which kind of changed the narrative, changed in the last like 10 years or so. I guess I'm also thinking about how, like, the future of it as a viable alternative, because at the same time, it's really fascinating to me to imagine currencies not pegged to sovereign states. That I think is like a very, there's something very democratic about that. But there is, I think, also the fact that it's tied to like there's a natural human desire to seek shelter or to seek commodities and goods that are almost like protected from historical changes. People have sought that over with gold, or even before that with like, having like, a cow or like some kind of herd, like, you know, your own farm, you would have certain things you would consider to be valuable that would hold value. Right. And it's natural. We as humans are always looking for where we can store value in case of like big disruption. And I think Bitcoin right now has emerged as a kind of safe haven. But at the same time, I'm skeptical of it, like how it would actually fare in an actual world economic crisis. And by this, I mean, when conditions are actually unstable, let's say in a situation of like, it would require like in serious disruptions to the world financial system. I'm wondering if Bitcoin would necessarily survive. I'm also wondering if in 10 years, those cryptographic systems that Bitcoin is based off of could be potentially with quantum computing also be undone. So there's a lot of risk there too. And additionally too, like with the like declining emission rate, I mean, it's possible that a lot of the miners will not find it profitable at all. And there could be a lot of bankruptcies. And also, all things considered, I mean, this is like caught up in the weeds of it a little bit, but I view Michael Saylor and the whole strategy thing to be a little bit of a Ponzi scheme, slightly, especially with like the selling of stock and then loans and then buying more Bitcoin. It seems to me they're wrapped up in the financialized instruments that I really find to be like negative forces in the economy. And the fact that Bitcoin has become so financialized is for me evidence that it will, I mean, the larger it becomes an integral to the financial system, if financial system, you know, goes down, I'm not entirely sure Bitcoin will survive that, or it will survive it, but it'll probably suffer immensely in value too. So is it really a safe haven as people are claiming?
Yeah, no, those are interesting observations. I do wonder myself, you know, this kind of development of the stock market and, you know, the global economy being led by, I guess, people's, at least in the US, and that, you know, people's wealth being tied up in either their house or in the stock market, and there's questions of value, of parking value, especially when we start seeing global uncertainty, maybe a fracturing of the unipolar world, certainly moving towards not a unipolar world. And in those situations, is this maybe sort of arcing back towards the kinds of situation we had in the 20th century, in the earlier 20th century, where states maybe didn't trust each other? You know, give me the hard money. I'm not going to take your paper. We saw, the development of, the emergence of the Weimar Republic of questionable approaches towards monetary systems and kind of a lot of frothiness. And I do wonder whether this inflection point that seems to be underwriting all of this conversation, you know, whether it's the Iran situation, which seems to echo, the second oil shock and the development of neoliberalism quite closely. It's kind of an interesting historical parallel there. But I do wonder whether this safe haven, this kind of place beyond the reach of the state or beyond the reach of certain forces is quite appealing, and whether that at this time could be something like Bitcoin, and whether that maybe then, is the gateway through which the next thing emerges. Because coming back to this question of central banking, one of the developments I've been following quite closely is the development of central bank digital currencies and these kind of very controlled, maybe perhaps even permissioned systems where, someone's given an injection of money straight into their bank account from the state, things like universal basic income, these kinds of questions start to emerge. And I mean, that is a certain, that is, seems like that's a technocratic pathway. And so having something outside of that that's decentralized and kind of the Wild West maybe provides quite of a nice hegemonic balance where maybe for now you can still escape and get out of that that kind of walled garden of state money and go into somewhere else. And so I think, sorry, there's a lot of stuff there, but it's sort of, it seems like having that escape valve, that escape hatch for your money and for capital even is quite valuable. If we do start seeing, you know, a crackdown in what you can actually spend your money on, that sort of thing. So I don't know, did you have any sort of thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, this is also goes back to what I was saying with Bitcoin being integrated into the financial system, because I think if you really, if there were actual true, like complete true believers of that, I mean, people would use privacy-focused currencies, those like Monero and these other ones too. So there is like, why aren't people using that? Like, why has that declined in value? I mean, it's declined in value because Bitcoin is a heavily financialized instrument. And I understand like the, especially when it comes to like just Ethereum and these other things, like it's very easy to send the money, but I'm very curious about, like, it's just funny to me because I've seen the narrative change from like down with the bankers to like now we're waiting for institutional money. And it just seems funny to me how like, it's just like flipped, you know, in the last 5, like 10 years or so for crypto. And also with Bitcoin, I mean, like I said, I mean, with its integration into BlackRock and now, like, it seems to me like if a lot of the financial system is tied up in Bitcoin, especially retirement accounts and stuff like this, I'm just wondering if like that safe haven is like more of a, like an illusion than anything else. I'm not entirely convinced that that's, because really there, I'm not trying to be like a pessimist here, but I'm not entirely convinced that there's, for me, it's like, I would rather have like land and a house than have Bitcoin personally. But then again, I also think Bitcoin will go up because I'm privy to the trends, but I'm not a believer in its, in it being like this, like the teleology of financial systems is like heading toward that. I'm not entirely convinced of that because at the same time, Bitcoin is becoming hotly integrated with the state. You know, America and China are competing for, you know, Bitcoin also. So it's wrapped up in geopolitical rivalries. And, you know, and also the state, the American state has realized that stable coins in particular, and also Bitcoin, are traded in dollars. So keeping the crypto market afloat also keeps the keep the US dollar afloat. And that might replace the petrodollar. You know, it might be very attractive if crypto is traded only in dollars. That's a huge boost to the, to, you know, dollar supremacy too.
Yeah, no, I understand and appreciate this is, I mean, this is a big question. And I guess coming back to the kind of the billiard balls of history of these different trajectories, I do think it is worth our time to sometimes consider, you know, what happens after the thing that happens next. And I think when I look around me, certainly having a house or having land is a nice thing, but having a self-sovereign Bitcoin, you know, it is a technical project. You do have to know a few things to be able to self-custody. Not that much, but you need to know a few things at least. But then once you start getting into that space, it's an interesting, I guess, vantage point from which to look at things. And also, you know, there's what people say something is, and then there is what it actually is. And I think, well, you know, what we're seeing is that it is just sort of cruising along and it's been going for what, 16, you know, sort of years now. I think it's an interesting kind of piece. And I think it feeds back into this idea of history and technology, you know, that this thing's out of the bag now. We've got this thing with the aspects of hard money, but it's also able to move at the speed of light. You know, there's a lot of things in there that just certainly weren't possible in the older period. And arguably the internet, you know, always needed something like Bitcoin to go with it. You know, why were we still using these state-based systems for money transfer? And so I think it's a rich field for discussion. But what I just wanted to kind of close on this idea, coming back to this idea of humanism, Anton, as you talk about in your article, as tech elites promise the next Garden of Eden, technology is again being proselytized as the only path to revolutionary change. And I think this is interesting because it seems to me that that has an almost eschatological kind of end of world kind of a connotation to it, that we have to go through the technology to get to this kind of this, you know, the promised land. And I do wonder whether you see that around you, or how you reflect on this idea of nihilism, of the despondent kind of perpetually online world that we're living in, and that somehow, you know, people are looking for something to hold on to. And maybe is it technology that is the shining light that everyone's reaching out for, or is it something else? How do you sort of see all of that stuff coming together?
Yeah, I've always characterized technological progress as a kind of cruel optimism. And this comes from Lauren Berlantz. She's a writer, and she had this concept called cruel optimism, which I think is essentially when you desire something that's also an obstacle for your flourishing. So it's optimistic in the sense that you expect it to happen, but it's cruel because it actually suffocates you in a way. And oftentimes I see in historical junction points, moments in where people are desiring things that are actually creating their own undoing. And I think in this case, I don't think people are desiring technological progress per se, although there are a lot of aspirations, people, especially in medical science and things like that. But generally speaking, I think there's been a lot of pessimism about technology nowadays, but there's also this expectation that it's just going to keep going. So like, you know, there's a lot of pessimism, but there's also, yeah, it's baked into the narrative that like, technology is going to keep improving, accelerating, et cetera, et cetera. And so in a way, it's kind of cruel because we're not actually directing its fruits. We're basically, these systems are designed really to extract attention and value that are not redistributed in any meaningful way. Most of the time. And the tragedy for me has been, in my understanding of like historical processes the last few decades, has been the decline of labor, which I think was once associated with a lot of the values that I think are very positive, in the sense that there was a kind of honor about labor, and there was a lot of culture around labor that politically also produced radical change, but also was rooted in actual material reality. You know, labor controls the levers of society. So by disrupting labor, you can enact actual changes in society. That's obviously not true anymore because labor has been a diminishing, labor less and less creates value in contemporary economies than before. Most of value is created as intangible. So that poses a problem because like politics used to be based on this organizing principle. And nowadays, you're wondering what really is what ties people together. What's the what creates that impetus for like a common we, the narrative for the future, right? And when I think of the last developments of the last 30 years, there is a lot of misplaced there's people are like fumbling in the dark, not knowing where the agitation is coming from, and a lot of things are being thrown at the wall. Like politically, we're living in very volatile times. And that's all a symptom, I think, of a lack of common narrativizing. There's not a lot of material bases for people to collectively organize anymore. And the decline of labor, for me, has impacts on the arts. It has impact on all aspects of society, really, politics. And the rise of technology and the new systems that emerged in the creation of value, not only does it remake the economy, but it also remakes culture. It remakes how people relate to each other. It remakes expectations for the future. And that's where I think you get into a lot of individual pathologies that I think are being felt nowadays, especially like loneliness and a rise of mental illness. And in general, I think we have less of a social contract nowadays because civil society, which used to be a strong bedrock, has really eroded. And technocracy is not so much like people want technocracy. It's almost like it's filling in a vacuum that was tragically lost and eroded over many, many decades. And that's where I put like I have a tendency to view things in kind of more of a tragic lens when I do history writing because it's very much, I'm interested in like decline and those topics, but I do think we're living in like a nadir period for political activity and labor in particular. We're living in a nadir period for labor, and that's I think deeply felt, almost like an elephant in the room amidst all this technological change.
Yeah, well, it's perhaps a search for meaning, a search for belonging. As I said, I was reading one of your other essays, Living in a Time of Psychopolitics, from 2023, and you expand on this idea by a Korean philosopher, Byung-Chul Han, of psychopolitics, that rather than controlling bodies, Han argues psychopolitics is mainly about souls and minds. And I think of riding the train into Tokyo and seeing every single person on their phone, of clickbait, of algorithmic content, of doom scrolling. And I can't help but see a connection there where, you know, there is a physical reality of time and space, but then there's also this kind of digital virtual reality. And how much of that is now AI generated or algorithmically targeted to kind of pull people into that kind of digital opium den, you know, that inescapable recline and perhaps nihilism of that world on the other side of the screen. And I think it's quite a powerful idea to deal with, because, you know, here we are talking across the world through a computer screen, you know?
Right, yeah. I mean, one of my first essays that I wrote, which was actually got traction online, was precisely about that question.
Okay.
Yeah. And Byung-Chul Han, when I read him initially, for me, this was like really touched on. He has a tendency to write in very polemical style, you know, like he's like almost like, Psychopolitics is like a book that's maybe like 30, 40 pages. It's very, very short. And in it, he essentially just diagnoses this. He tracks this like trajectory of how power has shifted towards the psychological, the controlling of minds. And it's very different from, you know, the prior system of 100 years ago, which was mainly about bodies, because industrial society is all about bodies, making sure bodies are healthy, making sure they get up on time for work. That's when you invented the census. So like the management of physical bodies was very important to like the early technocrats and the actual, like in the early 1900s. And huge political parties were created to speak to these people who were coming out of the, you know, the industry and had desires that perhaps were unfulfilled. But now you don't have, it's not so much management of bodies as much as it's management of, it's psychological. That's the mode of power nowadays. And that also tracks with the rise of therapy speak and the therapeutic language and all these things that have really emerged in the discourse almost like invisibly, like, self-care and that's all wrapped up in, we're really like, yeah, it's like that hyper-individualist, psychologized like way we live nowadays, which is hard to escape. I mean, we're all kind of stuck in our heads more than ever. That's just a fact.
No, understood. Well, look, Anton, I mean, what is your outlook for the future over the next, say, decade? I mean,
My outlook, I would say, has always been... So it's funny because I'm surrounded by a lot of people who have taken a very, very doomer look on AI, with like an escape mentality. Like you got a few years, then you only got a few years to exit. Otherwise you're screwed basically. Like this, like the future is like looking very futile. You know, either you're at the top or at the bottom. That seems to be like amongst, you know, what I'm reading, like my friends, like that seems to be some ideas that are like floating around for sure. I'm not entirely like, I'm not like full doomer or anything. Cause at the end of the day, I always like to frame my writing in a kind of like, that Promethean spirit of people. I just believe that humans have that potential, or else if I didn't believe that, I think I'd just go insane. Like there has to be some kernel of like belief in
you got to believe that Sisyphus enjoyed pushing that rock up the mountain, right?
There has to be some belief in like that like, you know, fire, you know, that exists in people. So, but at the same time, I do think that there's a lot of nefarious forces at play. And I also think that the American way of life is very much like the U.S. I'm very much skeptical of like the unipolar moment and the U.S. power and the limitations of U.S. power. So on the horizons, I am just thinking that, you know, the Iran war for me is evidence of a lashing out of a dysfunction in the, you know, in American power. And where that goes in the next, you know, there's a lot of debate happening. Is American power in decline? Is it just reorienting itself? And there's also questions of like, is it the Chinese century, things like that. Where I stand on that, I think Chinese foreign policy is definitely more effective on the PR level in the sense that they build things. Americans now, I mean, I think the image of America has really suffered. And I don't say this with any sort of like, I say this just as like a fact based on like, you know, polling done across the world. So where the world is headed in 10 years, I definitely think technological change is like the number one catalyst. So the rise of AI and these kind of things are gonna, I don't think people are truly aware of how uprooted these changes, like what, how destabilizing these changes will be. And that's why I think is the fear is that, because in my, I'm very interested in like pre-World War I period, and not to be like, you know, I don't want to be like a, draw too close of a parallel or anything, but I'm fascinated by previous people who lived in accelerating times and how they dealt with that, how they talked themselves into catastrophe. And I do think there is now a lot of emotional energy that is misdirected, or maybe isn't even, is just like sitting underneath in this like unconscious that is like occasionally lashing out. So I'm very afraid of like the crowd and how people operate and how in a state of emergency people can be, you know, how a public can be whipped into shape to support anything. And we kind of saw that with during COVID and stuff like that. So,
Well, essentially, are you familiar with Robert Musil, The Man Without Qualities?
Oh, I love him. Yeah, he's
okay. Amazing. I'm just working through that book, and you mentioned prior to World War I, and obviously this story set just prior to the war, and I find it very interesting, this kind of confluence of science, of religion, of modernity, rationalism, all these kind of ideas boil down into this fictitious state somewhere in Austria, and it's just a really interesting take on, I think, man's great question in modernity, you know, why am I here? What am I doing? And it's a profound read. I mean, it's a long read, but I think perhaps we're entering into that moment, you know, now 100 and something years later, we're asking a lot of questions. You know, where do we stand? What is our, you know, what is the bedrock upon which we build our lives? And how do we go from here? I think it's as you say, it's an inflection point, right?
Yeah. I mean, I love Robert Musil, and that book is definitely a huge inspiration for me. And actually what I'm writing now is very much in light of, because I've always been interested in Austria-Hungary and pre-World War I, especially modernist writers. And I'm reading their books. I feel like they're more in touch with what's happening now than a lot of contemporary literature. So I'm a big proponent of Robert Musil, Stefan Zweig, Joseph Roth, and, just like, yeah, there's these like Austro-Hungarian modernists who understood what it was like to live on the edge. And once it all disappeared, they had, you know, very, they had to pick up the pieces and understand where it went wrong. Like, how did this state, which had hundreds of years of history, how did the machinery of it just like not understand that it was destroying itself? And that's why I think they picked up the pieces. And it's like very fascinating for our context nowadays.
Yeah, and of course, you know, as we look back, I mean, for myself, just next week will be Anzac Day, which is the, you know, kind of the day remembering the New Zealand and Australian soldiers who fought in the wars, and in particular 1915, the ill-fated invasion of Turkey, where, you know, thousands of people from the other side of the world, New Zealanders, Australians, went over, sent to this pointless fight, and died on these beaches in Turkey. And we sort of remember that as our national holiday. People recall the trench warfare, the technological developments of the war, you know, the 19th century styles meeting 20th century technology, styles of warfare, and this great tragedy, this kind of absolute pulverization, evisceration of human bodies with machine guns and barbed wire and stuff. And I think, you know, how does that map on to this new, brave new world of drones and AI targeting and all these things? You know, I do wonder whether that, in a sense, is a kind of a meta kind of repetition of kind of an old way and a new way kind of colliding. And I don't know, man, maybe the biopolitics of the First World War, of human flesh versus machine gun steel, is that now in the 21st century, the human soul, you know, sort of dodging a drone that's targeting them based on their you know, their browsing habits or something. You know, there's a lot of questions to ask, and it can be a little bit dystopian, I must admit. But I've, as you say, having a little bit of hope and writing about it, talking about it is helpful. So if people want to follow your work, Anton, they want to see what you're up to, where do you want to send them?
Yeah, so they can follow me on my Substack, which is I write at novum.substack.com. And there I publish basically in my independent writing, but I've also been published in a couple of magazines, namely Noema, Brooklyn Rail, The Guardian, and Palladium Magazine. And I have a forthcoming piece coming out in Aeon, which is actually touches on a lot of these World War I themes. So that's going to be, I'm excited for that to come out soon.
Okay, that's awesome. So well, thank you very much for your time, Anton.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. I am Cody Allingham, and that was The Transformation of Value. If you would like to support this show, please consider making a donation either through my website or by directly tipping to the show's Bitcoin wallet, or just pass this episode on to a friend who you think may enjoy it. And you can always email me at hello@thetransformationofvalue.com.